session number 10599, reel 20.
Major English, reel 20. Can you describe, Major, what the term rest really meant?
Yes, when one was pulled back into a reserve position, particularly after a battle such as we'd had at Saint-Pierre, it was really a very busy time. There was reorganization to carry out in respect of evening up platoons and sections, if possible, and re-equipping. And for instance, the Bren Gun magazines for Bren Gun, which were I think numbered 20 for each gun, were distributed throughout the section and carried by the various members of the section. Well, if in fact some members of that section have become casualties, then very often their Bren Gun magazines hadn't been taken off them. And this is the sort of thing that one had to check to see that we were going to the next town we needed them and that the thing was going to be in the proper sort of order. And was always making lists of things that were required that had to be passed down to the quartermaster's department. And at Cashy, we did receive reinforcements, which I thought spoke well for the A side of the operation. In other words, the adjutant general side of the operation, really, that in a period just a few days after D-Day, that the reinforcements were there pretty well straight away.
Do you recall where they came from?
They were they were mainly Durhamite infantry. In fact, I think they were all Durhamite infantry. And they, of course, had been earmarked for early reinforcement. We got 11 officers. In other words, we'd lost 12. We got 11 and 190 other ranks, so which made us up to strength. And C Company was reformed. Then, on the 15th of June, at 9:30, the battalion moved off from Cashy to Langevin, where we took over from the 2nd Gloucesters. And they were a battalion in 56th Brigade, which was the 4th Brigade in 50 Div, attached to or under command of 50 Div for the invasion and the end of early days afterwards. There we learnt that the 9th Battalion had had a very bad battle at Verrières and through to Langevin. And Langevin was important, obviously, to the Germans because it was astride an important road to Villers-Bocage. There, A and my company, D Company, were the forward companies, and we were across south of the main road. That night, we got into these positions and improved them from the Gloucesters. And that night, we were heard a enemy out in front, and the sentry, one of the sentries in 16 platoon, challenged. The Germans replied with some shots, and everyone stood to. The sentry replied with Bren Gun fire, and the platoon sergeant immediately looked out the 2-inch mortar parachute flares. We had, I think, six rounds of parachute flares, and we shoved these in. The first didn't go off, second didn't go off, the third didn't go off. We fired them all, and none of them went off. And of course, they'd all been soaked in the landing on D-Day. Anyway, there was no further to it than that. We've a little bit of firing. There was no assault on the position or anything of that sort. And the next morning, we found one dead German and quite a lot of equipment left about. And this German, again, was from the Panzerlehr division. So I think if we had got some flares up, we might have done even more damage. We were in that position for 3 days, and then the battalion moved forward to a piece of the Bocage which was known as the Parc de la Mer, and that's about a mile south of Langevin. And here my company was the left rear company, and this was our first taste really of the the Bocage and the close nature of the country. And I think perhaps later on I might say a bit about the routine and what the Bocage was like. But we'd took up positions there, and once again the brigadier, and that was the second brigade commander we'd had, he was wounded, and RCO Bob Little had to go back to command the brigade.
What was the name of this brigadier, Major?
I think his name was Brigadier Walton, who really had only been with us for maybe a week or a little more. There was a lot of accurate German shelling at this time. It was obvious, of course, to them that our positions were in the hedges and the lanes, and these could be registered fairly well. And their shelling and mortar fire was very effective. There was one particularly nasty stonk, as it was called, which is a heavy and short concentration of artillery fire, came down, and this was on the 18th. The adjutant was killed, the signal officer was wounded, and the carrier platoon commander. And we learnt there then and later on the importance of head cover. And this was something that I think was new to us. We also, of course, learned going with that, the importance of concealment. But very often they had airburst shells, and these head cover was an important feature as protection against that. We'd had airbursts to some extent in the desert and in Sicily, but head cover really was almost impossible. It would need vast quantities of corrugated sheeting or something of this sort. So in fact, we couldn't have that. But we started making head cover of saplings and this sort of thing.
Were these shrapnel shells that were bursting?
Yes, yes, that's right. And we also set up then a sniper section who were picked out from the companies, men who were very good at field craft, who would conceal themselves, and of course who were also good shots. We knew the first-class shots and the marksmen in the companies, and these became very effective. And it's something, of course, we were really just copying the Germans. On the next day, we learned that 231 Brigade were to attack through our positions up to the village of Hotto. And Hotto was another village on this main road ahead of us. There was considerable artillery support fire, and for some reason or another, the barrage started in our positions. I think 8th July were all right, because I mean we had slit trenches and to go to and head cover of some sort anyway, but of course it caught the companies of the Hampshires that were going through us and possibly the second Dorsets as well on their start line, and this
how quickly could you put a stop to that? There was communication back to the artillery.
Yes, in an attack of that sort, of course, they have a forward observation officer mobile with probably the leading companies. But in a thing like a barrage, a fairly set piece attack, it's not very easy to stop a part of it, without stopping the whole. Now, if you recollect, we were talking about the Battle of Marath, and there we had some guns that caused casualties to my company before we crossed the Wadi. And Peter Wakelin was the FOO from 74th Field Regiment with me, and he said, well, those are sure, I'm certain that those are our guns, but I will try, but I have no great hopes of stopping it. And in fact, we couldn't. So it isn't easy. The Hampshire attack was pressed pretty hard, but they got into the village, but were thrown out again, and the Dorsets on the left occupied their part of the village and were there for overnight, but were knocked out, driven out again. And in fact, it was a village that was not captured till the 18th of July. In other words, virtually another a month ahead. The German defensive fire, while this attack was going on, was very accurate. The OCC company had arrived at Cashy as a reinforcement. It was a regular officer called Arthur St. George. He was killed, and Captain Welsh, who'd been my second in command in the Derrith, he was, and my excellent colour sergeant Baron, who was an old territorial, he was also killed with this fire, and I was particularly sorry to lose him, because I don't think D Company ever went short of anything. If it was humanly possible to get it, he would get it. And he was a big loss. The Germans had some tanks in the area, particularly around a large house called the Chateau du Cordillon. And this was an old-style manor, I suppose, with a walled garden around it, and the Germans were very strong there, and their tanks were concealed there. And one success which we had, not my company, but B Company, B Company had a lane running into their positions, and they put down a series of Hawkins grenades, a string. These are anti-tank grenades that one can string together. And Lieutenant Jallon's platoon had one of these out. And they were approach there was about 50 to 100 yards ahead of them, and they were approached by this tank, and all the men were down in their slit trenches ready to shoot, and the German tank ran over the Hawkins grenade and blew its track off, and the crew jumped out and were either killed or taken prisoner. So that was a good success, and went round the news went round the battalion fairly quickly. On that particular day, I think the 19th of June, I was told I'd been promoted to major. And Jimmy Califer, my second in command, was appointed OCC company. Again, we had reinforcements at that time. We had to go, 7 officers, another 89 other ranks came up. And included in these officers were 4 Canadians. And these were the first, in fact, I think they were the only Canadians we had. And this was under a scheme where the British Army was becoming short of infantry officers. And at that time, the Canadian Army that had, I think, 3 divisions at that stage in the field, and to some extent the South African Army also had could spare some infantry officers. And this Canloan scheme, as it was called, was very good. And these chaps were jolly good. They were well trained. And they were, apart from, I think, the question of pay, which was on a Canadian Army level, slightly better than ours, but otherwise than that, they were exactly the same. They were in the British Army, really, for all intents and purposes. And I had a Lieutenant Morrison who came to my company, and I think after a day or two settling down with the Durhams, he became extremely effective. Now, we were to remain in the Bocage for some weeks, and it might be appropriate perhaps to describe the Bocage as it was known. It was a dairy farming area, really, of Normandy, characterized by extremely small fields and sunken lanes and tall, very thick hedges. And it was very good for concealment, but difficult to attack through. And the battalion found it certainly found it strange after the desert. And in many cases, the visibility would never be more than a couple of hundred yards. And in 1 or 2 cases, I think the nearest we had, there was a German position about 35 yards from us. it was good for snipers, and I mentioned we formed a sniper section, but we got used to it. We perfected our head cover, and we dug down pretty well. And I think the battalion, we got to like it at the finish. And of course, everyone was living in the slit trenches. The mortars came into their own. Anti-tank guns really couldn't. They were very useful, but they were obviously firing at short range. And the carrier platoon, the carriers were. You couldn't use them because it wasn't open enough. But of course, their firepower, the carrier platoon, the Bren guns, they were used to thicken up positions. But in his platoon level, we found the Piat very useful, firing direct at enemy positions, infantry positions, and in one case, a Lieutenant Wyatt, who was come up as a reinforcement to D Company, and who'd been training in England while we had been abroad. He was a jolly good platoon commander, and he'd learned that you could set a piot up like a mortar. And we annoyed the Germans to some extent with doing that.
So the piot could be used with a shell other than an armour-piercing shell?
No, it couldn't really. No, it was just the one type of ammunition, and it was really at the German head cover. We had no direct evidence about how effective it was, and we thought it might be. We didn't use it a great deal at that. And the 3-inch mortars found that with the poor visibility and not being able to get OPs up into high points, that they were shooting off the map virtually. And we also got some very good air photos where every field was marked. And these were to a scale, and they used these. And very effective it was too. The other problem in the battalion area, and indeed I think throughout the forward area, was the dead cows. I mentioned this was a dairy farming area, and they had some very fine dairy cattle, but these suffered the most dreadful casualties, and there were many, many dead cows about. Well, quite apart from if there'd been no war on at all, digging a grave for a cow takes quite a bit of doing. And, of course, in the circumstances, they didn't really get buried at all, and the smell became absolutely ghastly. Further back, and as the rear area became sorted out, they sappers produced bulldozers and this type of thing, and there were some buried in that way. But while the front was fairly static in Normandy, cows, dead cows, were a real problem.
What had happened to the civilian population? Had they left before the fighting started?
Yes, they were there in many cases on D-Day, and they did, in fact, unfortunately, suffer some casualties. Those who were on the coast, I think, probably stayed because the British Army pushed through. But in the hinterland, they left the farms were more or less deserted, and we didn't really see any civilians. There were quite a number of casualties in a place like Tilly that suffered extremely heavy fighting.
Did you come across any of the resistance fighters?
No, not till later, not till the thing became mobile. But we were told, the information came down, that some of the reinforcing German divisions had been considerably delayed. First of all, of course, by the Air Force and the knocking out of the bridges by the Air Force, but the direct attacks by the Air Force, but also, and most importantly too, by the Mackie, who attacked the German columns. But at that time, we didn't meet any German resistance. Well, now the routine in the Bocage, we always stood two, and this was midsummer, of course, so that was pretty early. It was normally, I think, from 4:30 to 5:30. And then everyone got a bit more rest, apart from the sentries. And we had proper rotas going, of course, for sentries in the platoons and sections. And then about an hour after stand down, the company quartermaster sergeants brought up breakfast and also a light midday meal. A bit of bully beef probably and biscuits, or perhaps maybe cheese and biscuits and margarine. And this midday meal was brewed up in the in the platoon positions. We had little platoon cookers. And during the day, we improved the positions, improved head cover, cleaned weapons, and possibly sent out patrols. Both day and night patrols were organized, and the importance of patrolling in a situation like this, of course, is tremendous.
How was the patrol made up, Major?
Well, it depended on the task. If it was purely to get information, it would be either an officer or an NCO and perhaps two men. If it was required to get information and perhaps by fighting for it, well, it could be a complete section or two sections, might even be a platoon. And that took place in one or two instances, but mostly it was reconnaissance patrols. The German artillery and mortar fire, of course, was pretty wearing. That we had quite a lot of that every day. And then at about 8 o'clock in the evening, the evening meal came up, and usually then the mail came up, and that was working pretty well. I think everyone got mail, and there wasn't the tremendous delay, of course, of weeks and weeks which we'd had in the desert. And then the patrols, if there were going to be patrols, going out at night, they were preparing and being briefed. And I should have perhaps mentioned that we appointed a battalion patrol officer because of this particular piece of warfare was so important, and this was in fact, in our case, the second in command. Then again, stand two at normally about 10 in the evening to about 11 or half past 11, depending on the lightness of the night. Quite often there were various scares and German patrols approaching and this sort of thing in the night. The patrols learnt that the Germans, of course, in their expert way, were mining the whole area and all round Chateau de Cordillon, and the little lanes and tracks there were all mined, and some of the farms were booby trapped as well. I think in the first 8 days in the Bocage, we lost 10 officers and 90 other ranks, which was really very high, considering that we weren't in a large-scale battle. I think it showed the accuracy of the German fire, really.
This would be very largely mortar and shell fire.
That's right. Yes. Yep.
Overall, did the men stand up to this?
Well, pretty well. As I relate, we were several weeks in the Bocage, and certainly by the end, we were feeling the effects of fairly static warfare. I think the position really was that it was all according to the Montgomery's plan, where the British Second Army and the Canadian Army, when it was formed, would attract the German armour by attacking on the left and to try and draw them away from the Americans on the right. And we were nearly on the right of Second Army, more or less in the centre of the Allied position. And so our positions were, as it were, the hinge for these other actions, and we weren't required to try and press ahead. So we were reasonably static. And on the 23rd of June, we were relieved by the first Hampshires, and we went to a brigade rest area at Busseel. And there we practiced a counterattack row. And again, of course, our deficiencies were made good and reorganization. And we were able, from that place, to send 4 to 6 men per company on a rota basis to B echelon for a bath and a change of clothes and a night's rest. And this was tremendous. This was greatly appreciated.